So I was going to start today. Last week I had in mind to start with the chart that I have. And I went to it and discovered that I did not ever do the gods of Babylon.
I wondered about that because I've never heard of that before. And everybody's bated breath for this.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So I started on the plague one in chapter 16, verses 1 and 2. I got embroiled in something that is going to take me days, maybe longer, to really accomplish. I mean, I will be spending a lot of time on just plague one. Lloyd understands this very well. I'm going to share with you today what I have gotten done, because it's enough for one meal. But I'm going to first tell you the story of how I kept discovering things. It's like you talk about God's timing. Something God has taught me before with his timing, and told me that his timing is always perfect. It is. So I the first plague. Well, let me open to Revelation. So I'm going to start with verses 1 and 2 of Revelation 16, and I'm going to give you as far as I've gotten. I have a book. Okay, so let me read verses 1 and 2 so you know what I'm going to be talking about. So the first angel poured his bowl on the earth, and a nasty and terrible sore appeared on the people who had the beast's mark and worshipped his image. So I got there, and I decided, at looking at the last plagues, that the God should probably fit what was affected by the plague, since it seemed to be targeted at a certain part of the earth. And the only thing I could think of with the body and sores being on the body was a book I have in my library that I've read part of, but never gotten through before. I still am not quite through. It's called The Rituals of War, The Body and Violence in Mesopotamia. Remember that these plagues are plagues on Babylon. And so I started reading and reading. It was mostly about war and kings. And she has a chapter on the mantic body, which has to do with magic and that sort of thing. Which I skipped over. I've read it before, but I didn't think it would be that helpful. I also looked up the word sore in Greek and discovered that it can mean wound. And I recognized that what I was reading about a lot was wounds on the body in war. There's a chapter on death and the ruler. I'm not going to read the whole chapter at all, but there's places where I want to read. She shows a picture in the book of the victory stela of Naram Sin. Naram Sin was one of the was the I think the next to the last, if not the last, king in the Akkad dynasty. Now, Akkad is short for Akkadian. And it's the name of the first Akkadian dynasty, which is really the first Babylonian dynasty. Solid Babylonian, because the Babylonians were Akkadian speakers. They weren't foreigners from some other place. They were Akkadian speakers, and that would fit more with true Babylonian. Now, they were before the old Babylonian period. They were in the third millennium. So this is the earliest that you would have A ruler. And I need to talk to you a little bit about Naram Sin, because before this chapter, Naram Sin was the grandson of Sargon the Great. Sargon the Great was the first king of the Akkad dynasty. And his father was king. Wait a minute. His father was king of Kish. Kish is where it is thought kingship began in ancient Mesopotamia. And I mean secular kingship, not kingship where the king is a priest king, which is a much softer kind of king, but simply a royal figure that had a lot of power in his kingdom. Naram Sin is the grandson of Sargon the Great. And he is, Naram Sin was called Danum, which in Akkadian means mighty. So I'm going to turn in my Bible to Genesis 10. You're probably guessing what I'm turning to.
Nimrod, mighty hunter.
Nimrod. So I have to pick this apart a little bit because otherwise it's not going to fit. And it does fit because what I'm going to share with you, I believe, is true of the text. So I want to start with verse 6. Ham's sons. Cush. Cush is Hebrew for Ethiopia. It's also Hebrew for some other things, but it's Hebrew for Ethiopia. And since Ham's sons produce Cush, it's probably Ethiopia. Because the Hamitic groups went into Egypt, went into other places. They were dark of skin, and so on. I'm not trying to sound racist, by the way. I'm just stating facts here. So Ham's sons, Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. Cush's sons, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, Sabteka, Rama's sons, Sheba, and Dedan. And now we have something strange. It's almost an anomaly. Cush fathered Nimrod. Wait, he already had sons. They were listed. But it says here, Cush fathered Nimrod, the first great warrior on the earth. Now, earlier versions are like RSV had Cush. Now, Nimrod was a mighty man. You can translate it either as warrior. If you repoint it, let me explain something about Hebrew. Hebrew originally had no vowel points. You had just consonants. And there were vowels in spoken Hebrew, but they weren't written down. Fact, they were not written down until around 700 to 1000 AD by the Masoretes. Consequently, we refer to the Hebrew Bible as we have printed with vowel points as the Masoretic text. So, that being the case, I believe that Cush, the second Cush, is a different location altogether. That the author, the scribe copying the text, because we only have copies, we don't have autographs of the Hebrew Bible. The scribe copying the text saw Cush, the first Cush, and he saw then the second Cush, which would be just KSH, KSH. And he thought they were spelled the same. And so he wrote them both in the Masoretic text, both Cush. But it should have been Kish. So what the early scribe thought is that Kish, he read Kish, But Cush reminded him of Kish, and so he inserted this comment. Cush fathered Nimrod, the first great warrior on earth. The Lord saw him as a great hunter, and so it is said, like Nimrod, whom the Lord saw as a great hunter. What does that have to do with Naram-Sin? In ancient Near Eastern culture, and I'm not sure, I can't prove that Naram-Sin would have done the hunt, but one of the things that kings did was go and hunt lions to prove their prowess. And this would be a reference, whether it's true of Naram-Sin or not, it would be a reference that it was understood that any king of worth his merit could hunt lions and kill them. There's actually reliefs, I think Assyrian reliefs, of the king going out on a hunt to kill a lion.
Did they never allow stories to stay in the record if the lion killed the king?
They're usually, I don't think they usually went alone. They took their servants with them. There's no record of any lion killing a king that I
So
know of.
they just wouldn't record it if it did
They
happen.
might not. Although, yeah, they might not. Anything dissing the king probably didn't get the re in the record. It's we scholar. There's a number of scholars working on subversive elements in ancient Near Eastern texts, especially Mesopotamian ones, and they have to look very between the lines and here and there and everywhere to try to find any subversive elements against the king. I think, given that he was called Danu, I think this could have been the Genesis writer's Naram-Sin, because Naram-Sin is much earlier than Genesis. So it would be this historic figure of antiquity to them. And it would be an attempt to show how kingship developed. So Naram-Sin is an exceptional ruler, is what this author maintains. Let me read a few things here that will make this more credible. The wars of Naram-Sin and the expansion of Akkadian political hegemony over a great part of the Middle East are well known from numerous written accounts. Along with the great increase in cuneiform texts from this period, which record dynastic rule, that information corroborates it from the archaeological record. The monuments of Akkad are important artifacts of the change in political power. The nature of kingship and the idea of centralized rule, as it was formulated for the first time as the he Akkadian hegemony over Sumer and Akkad. So there's a change of rule with the Akkad dynasty, but there's an even further change in rule with Naram-Sin. But this change is particularly clear in the victory stela of Naram-Sin. And I wish I could show this to you, but if I photocopied it, even you, it wouldn't be clear. It's very hard to see. You'd have to get the book, and I don't know that you want to spend the money on it. Books that I buy are pretty expensive. Just a warning. But this change is particularly clear in the victory stela of Naram-Sin, which formulates a new conception of kingship as not only a centralized authority entrenched on a single state, but as an ontological category in the world order. All Akkadian monuments are to some extent agents of this political change rather than simply reflections of it, but the Naram-Sin stela actively produces kingship and victory in terms of this new form of absolute power. This new concept of kingship was formulated and underscored through the body of the king. So, sores on the body, which affected everybody, king and commoner alike, in the plague, is an attack, in a sense, on the king. Of Babylon.
In effect, an abbreviated version would be that it dismantles the whole concept of hierarchy.
Yeah, well, everybody's treated alike in the
Yeah,
plagues.
it discredits that the king is exempt from being treated like everybody else.
Exactly. He's not above the law of nature
Which, like
or
in
war
Pharaoh,
or
when
whatever.
what was it? Was the lice or one of them where all of a sudden they're like all embarrassed because they're supposed to be exempt from this and they weren't? Remember?
You're talking about the Egyptian plagues?
Yeah, like the priest or whatever started being affected by one of the plagues, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, this must be the finger of God because, you know, it's affecting
Yeah,
us.
one of the plagues is like that because everybody's affected.
Yeah.
And of course, when the death of the firstborn, the king is distinctly affected.
Yeah.
This new conception of kingship was formulated and underscored through the body of the king, though that in itself was not entirely new, having been an aspect of images of local rulers in the Sumerian city-states during the early dynastic period in the middle of the third millennium BC. I'm going to skip to something else just briefly. One of the differences between the early dynastic period and the Akkad period, Akkad Empire period, is that in the early dynastic period, the kings were very careful to make sure that they fought a just war, which would be a war of defense, not a war of conquest. That changed with the Akkad kings, particularly Naram-Sin. And that, to me, just makes it all the more certain that he is Nimrod, because not only because of the fact that he's an offspring of King of Kish, but because he goes on to build all these kingdoms. One person can never build all these kingdoms. What the author is depicting is that Naram-Sin began as a trajectory in which king after king built these various kingdoms in his kind of rule.
Or that he
Interesting.
conquered, would it be that he conquered kingdom after kingdom and then assumes?
Babel, I don't think Babel was yet around.
In
This
my version,
is 2200 BC. I don't think Babel was around. I don't think he built Babel, but he started a trend that would.
Verse 10 in my translation has a footnote here that Nimrod is the first person in scripture described as having a kingdom normally associated with an imposed rule using force.
Oh, how interesting.
That's free Bible.
That's the
No.
free Bible.
Yeah.
That's what we're getting to. Just hang in there.
And I would also just note, Jonathan has translated Nimrod was the first tyrant.
And that's what was it? He's taking on after another. I think of Jonathan having done his PhD at St. Andrew University in Scotland. Well, it was a Scottish translator, and I'm blanking on his name, who translated it tyrant also, or despot. He translated despot, that was it. So let me read on. Under the Akkadian dynasty, the body of the ruler was presented as alluring, virile, and potent, the male conqueror who imposes his will on the world through geographic expansion and political control. What is of greater significance in both juridical and supernatural terms is the ruler's relationship to death and the law that has now changed. Considered in all its radicality, this ontological shift is biopolitical insofar as it constitutes absolute power in the sovereign's ultimate right to deal the blow of death. She talks about the traditional title King of Kish was used since, according to legend, kingship had descended to the world at Kish. That's why I think Kush is really Kish, because that's where they understood kingship to come from. The other thing you need to know about Naram Sin is that he uses a divine determinative as the prefix for his name. And he wears horns on his crown. That's a sign of divinity. So he proclaims himself not as just as having the ultimate power of a king, a human king, but the ultimate power of a god.
Okay, a footnote on the Passion Translation, verse 10, says that many believe that Nimrod was also named Marduk, whom scholars identify as the god of the Babylonian religions.
I have actually fiddled with taking that stance, because you can work it out. I've worked it out on my whiteboard in my classroom for my students to see when we come to this chapter in my Books of Moses class. But I kind of gave it up because I didn't feel it quite fit.
Gotcha.
Because there's so many possibilities. You could take Ninurta, who is the god of kings. And Ninurta fits even better than Marduk to
Okay.
Nimrod, because you have two ends in book. Oh no, wait a minute. Marduk could fit with that because it has an M. You know, I'll have to think about that. But Marduk was never a human being, and Genesis 10 is talking about a human being. True, he deified himself, but Marduk was always a god, just a god.
In verse 9, Nimrod defied or stood against the Lord.
This is the new
Free Bible.
Free Bible. Oh, Jonathan takes what I would like to, how I would like to translate that.
Well, he says,
because
oh, it was a powerful fighter who defied the Lord. And his footnote is subjugated, reads against or versus.
Huh. Because the Hebrew is, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. It's before.
Before.
But what does that mean? It's ambiguous. Because it doesn't necessarily mean it's positive. I had somebody try to persuade me to believe that it's positive, and he was embraced by Yahweh and blah blah blah, and I don't see that as positive, a positive statement. So
Yeah.
I would love to chat with Jonathan and find out how he came to that from the Hebrew. Maybe I should revisit the preposition before. Anyway, so she goes through this relief on this stela. Just look at the stela myself and tell you what's on it. It is a peaked stela that describes a mountain. And Naram Sin has gone against, apparently, the Lulabi. This is war over this group who lived in the Zagros Mountains northeast of Mesopotamia. He's obviously trying to conquer them. He is not doing a defense battle. The reason we know that is because there was a portrayal close to the king, not far from the king. The Lulabi king is holding both hands up like he's in prayer, pleading for mercy from Naram Sin. And she points out how Naram Sin is standing, and underneath his feet are dead human beings. And we know they are dead because they are naked. Those other soldiers from the Lulabi are still clothed or partially clothed, depending on how close they are to death. So what you have here is a king who believes he's a god, who is attempting to take, who has the power, that's what I want to say, who has the power over life and death. I'm looking here for where she states that more succinctly and articulately than I do. Okay, what is carved on it, meaning the stela, is indeed a representation of a historical battle against the Lulabi, but at the same time, we might see the stela is also an artifact of the historical junction in which kingship, a form of rule that had until then been conceived of in limited terms and with the local structure of the city-state, came to be defined as sovereign power. The victory stela of Naram Sin is not just the victory stela. It is also a monument of a new form of rule. One that has ceased to be a social political office now presents itself specifically as a category of ontology. In case ontology doesn't make sense there, what she means by it is it's a state of being coming. This has come into existence, and it's now a state of being, which will continue. And that's because it does continue. So now I'm going to turn to the next chapter. There's a lot more, but I didn't want to go into the whole thing. Oh, it's not the next chapter. She then goes into other forms of artifacts that relate to power. She moves back in time doing that, so I'm not going to. I had it just a few minutes ago. She has a chapter on Hammurabi's stela and the power of law as part of this trajectory. I'm not going to go over it. It's a little dense for me. I haven't quite figured out exactly what she's trying to say, but there is a connection there between this sovereign power and law. So that was that. And then today, well, there's other ways I could look at this. Today, it's an email. I opened my email to write the letter to everybody. And there was I belong to a group that have scholars that share their writings with people. Sometimes whole books are shared. And we pay $99 a year to get almost anything we need. There was one written by Z. Abush, who is an Assyriologist of quite a bit, quite well known Assyriologist. He wrote in a book a chapter on the body of the king. Well, the whole book is on the body of the king. And he wrote, in fact, let me open it up. I have it down here. Oh, I don't anymore. Anyway, he wrote a chapter on Enuma Elish and Marduk. I will be fascinated to read it. Because this is in a book on the body of the king. And Marduk, the reason why it's easy to think of it as Marduk for Nimrod is Marduk is the usurper of all the gods. He becomes king over all the gods by their agreement. And the reason I call him a usurper is because he buys their favor. They're stuck. They have Tiamat, the mother goddess, coming up against them because of Ea, Marduk's father, having killed their father. He committed patricide. And the other gods that side with her and sided with probably the older gods, sided with Apsu, who was the father god. They are up in arms about the fact that she just stood by and didn't do anything. So they incite her to battle against the younger gods. And she is coming up against them. And first they send Anu, then the high god, who's Anshar at this point, sends Anu, and Anu turns around and heads back because he can't face her. She's so terrifying. So then they send another god. One of them is Ea, Marduk's father. All the gods, I think they send three gods, and all three of them turn tail and run. They can't face Tiamat. Well, Tiamat is sea, salt water. We'll meet her again in the second plague. Anyway, they're in a bind. They can't get anybody to take on Tiamat. And so Ea tells Marduk, Marduk, you talk about a body that is superlative. Marduk has four eyes and four ears. And in all the depictions of Marduk, he's a very powerful looking god. So they paint this picture of him as that, and he comes in before Anshar and he says, I will go and fight Tiamat if you will make me the ruler over all of you. She's the chief king over all the gods. And they're in a bind. They have nowhere to go. So they agree. And that's how he gains his power. And at the end of Enuma Elish, he is given 50 names. And he is said to, and one of the statements they make is, in every place where there is a shrine, you are the god of that place. It's not said in quite those words, but it means that. And it's almost like taking the statement of Jesus, as you have done it unto the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you have done it unto me, and inverted it. I pointed that out to my Akkadian professor when we came to this first line. She liked it. I don't think she understood it was inverted. I didn't have the language yet. It takes me a while to get new ideas in my head with the right language, but it's an inverted statement. Now, having said that, keep in mind that all the gods are demons in the Bible. Remember last week I shared Deuteronomy 32:17.
What's Deuteronomy 32:17? Just for memory.
You offered sacrifice to demons instead of God, to gods you didn't know anything about, to brand new gods that your forefathers didn't worship.
So
I would.
Marduk is a brand new god.
Mm-hmm.
It would fit in that category. Baal could even fit in that category, I suspect.
I think it's worth adding verse 18, by the way. You dismissed the rock who fathered you. You forgot the God who gave birth to you. I mean, it is the rejection language in favor of
Right.
something false.
Right. So that's as far as I've gotten.
Before we started and we were just chatting, so correct me if I'm missing or have misapplied, but there was somebody who came along yanking the chain of Marduk and got him to leave his temple and then wreaked havoc on the people of Babylon.
Oh, Era. Okay, let's talk about the god of the plague. I forgot that. This fits all the plagues. The god of the plague is Nergal, who is a warrior. There's also a god of the plague in Mesopotamia that is Era, who is also a warrior. And they merged. This was not the choice of the gods to merge. This was the choice of people who got them confused with each other. Or fused, maybe. So, one of the gods being in charge of the plague, or the all the plagues, is Era. He's also known as the god of hell. So, I was telling Bill and Peggy about my dissertation, chapter 8. I think I've told you that I determined that the divine speeches were built on Enuma Elish tablets 4 and 5 because there's so many parallels. I mapped them all out in my dissertation. My Akkadian professor thought I really had something. It was such, they were so closely fit to even the right word at the right time that I decided that that had to be one of the sources of the author, that he was responding to Enuma Elish and dissing Marduk because he combines Marduk with Tiamat. And she becomes the god of chaos. I mean, he becomes the god of chaos in Job. So I decided there must be more. If the author of Job used one text in Akkadian, he must use another one. I mean, there must be more that's going on. And it would mean that he was trying to show that Yahweh was the superior God in terms of theodicy. And so I started looking at other texts, and one of them was Era, the poem of Era. Era saunters in, well, Era first gets incited against the Babylonians or incited to do war. He complained that his warriors complain that their weapons are getting rusty and they need to be used or they'll be useless. But Era wants to do something to gain fear because he feels like an inferior god. Nobody worships him. Nobody does anything for him. He's kind of out there on his own. And so he saunters in before Marduk, king, the god of Babylon, and he says, "Marduk, I see that your crown is tarnished. And why is your temple so dirty? Haven't the Babylonians been keeping it up? What happened to the Akitu festival?" I'm adding some things that aren't there, but I'm just trying to make the point. Anyway, he mocks Marduk, and Marduk gets angry at the Babylonians. Oh, I'm going to leave so that they can do something with this temple, because the temple couldn't be cleaned unless the god left. That's like, by the way, a counter against the Day of Atonement. Day of Atonement, God is still in the temple while it's being cleaned. Anyway, the Akitu festival is the counterpart, is the opposite. Well, it's the Babylonian Day of Atonement. Some of the rituals are a little bit like Day of Atonement. Era blithely says to Marduk when he says he's going to leave the temple, "I will take your place while you're gone." Marduk agrees. And so he trots off out of the temple and Eras takes on the Babylonians. And in that work, I have my dissertation right here still. The Satan uses wind, fire, brigands, and disease against Job. Okay. Era uses wind, fire, armies, and diseases against the Babylonians. It's essentially the same. And I found so many similarities, once again, to the Satan in the book of Job between Era and him, that I came to conclude that the author had deliberately used that. So the Satan, if you go by that, the Satan could well be the god of hell. Certainly the god of the plague.
Or in
God in
Revelation,
Lucifer's
the
letters.
angel of the abyss.
Well, he is. I believe he is.
Yeah, but that would parallel it, wouldn't it? The abyss would be hell.
Yeah, you're right. In ancient Near Eastern understanding, that's true. So that's what Bill was referring to.
Because of the, and once Marduk left and he did some actions, it seemed. Was there more aligned to his issues with the plagues or the bulls that we end up seeing, or did I not quite get that?
He's aligned. Well, Era is aligned with all the plagues because
Okay.
he's the god of the plague.
Of the plague. Okay. So today we've looked at sores and see if I've got this right. We've looked at sores and suggested the possibility that it's self-inflicted wounds, or maybe not self-inflicted, but
War, and it could
adversarial.
be war inflicted wounds because he's a warrior
Okay.
god. It could mean that the first plague is a war and everybody gets wounded.
So as God's letting go,
Exactly. All the forces of evil that can't get along with any. But see, I think the taken point for me is feeling like we're living not in the time of the plagues, but in the time just before the plagues. Because it seems that God is already releasing his Holy Spirit on those who don't want him anyway. And what is happening is violence, absolute violence.
So what we're saying is the word translated sores.
I looked it up and it can mean wound.
So it doesn't necessarily mean sores.
No, it doesn't necessarily mean there's war, but it doesn't rule it out either.
No, I mean sores.
Sores doesn't mean, well, no,
It
the
doesn't have
dictionary
to be
gave,
translated sores, is what I'm saying.
that's
but
fair.
it, no, it doesn't have to be translated sores. There are three definitions, and two of them are wounds and sores.
What's the other one?
Let me look. That's it. Heilko is the word. My dictionary has very fine print. It takes me a while to see where it is. It's interesting. It's related to elkuo, which is a verb. It says drag about, tear asunder. It's a very violent word. So wound or sore would be the result of that violence, it seems to me,
Okay.
since it's related. Here we go, Elko.
So it could be bodily harm.
A wound, lacerate, ulcerate, to suffer from wounds or sores is also the verb form. Here we go. Elko.
I guess the difference between a wound and a sore would be one is an inflicted bodily harm, and the other one is an induced bodily harm. One's from the inside, and the other's from the outside.
What comes
to I don't know that there's a significant difference. The difference would be the cause.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Would be different, but I don't know that that's inherent in the word.
Right, right.
Well, one thought, Gene, I'm trying to get my mind around all that you're saying. So we worship a God who's creator and sustainer. Mm-hmm. And with God withdraws part of the bodily functions that are supposed to work when God is sustaining life, makes sense to me that that's if God is not continuing to sustain what happens, you know, there's breakdown. Things are not working the way that they're supposed to work. So I think, you know, that's an interesting thought as well as what you're saying, that right. you have these, it sounds like demonic forces in this hierarchy, you know, which made me think of Ephesians 6, where we're reminded, you know,
do not wrestle
on his mighty power, put on the armor of God so you can withstand all the devil's attacks. We're not fighting against human forces, but against right. supernatural rulers and powers, the dark lords of this right. world, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavens. So, and the little that I've studied about tyrants who we linked Nimrod with once, there's always all this infighting and and often murder. And, you know, that's why they're not very safe places to be if you're trying to ascend under a tyrant. So it just made me think again of how this fits perfectly with how Satan does things, which is to kill, steal, destroy. You know, it's mm-hmm. all Satan right. and the dark lords under him and whatever hierarchy they're infighting over. They're all intent on the same thing, which is destruction. Yeah. If God is pulling back and not continuing to sustain his original creation, you know, that to me makes a little bit more sense about this evil and how this, you know, suddenly happens to all the people that are out, not connected to the source of life. They're not written later on, you know, their references, those who are not written in the book of life. They haven't connected to the Lamb. They haven't experienced that spiritual renewal and connection to the life source.
Yeah.
So my little brain's trying to make sense of what I've been hearing. And
yeah.
Well, okay, does this fit?
Yeah. Yeah, that's my goal is to show that it fits with the text and it fits with ancient Near Eastern perceptions of deity. So it could be just source from the body breaking down or forces of nature taking place or someone fighting with someone and hurting them or some it, you know, but the key is this is violent because the verb form of that word is very violent.
Now, there's something else, another factor that plays in here, I think has to be included. And I like this idea of as the Spirit of God or the protection of God is withdrawn, not just, you know, not protection from everything, including your own ability, your body's natural ability to heal itself is now losing effect. And what's significant here is that when you get to the fifth plague, they're mentioned again. It says they blaspheme God, and the fifth plague is darkness on the throne of the beast. But then it says they blaspheme God because of their pains and their sores. And the sores are not part of the fifth plague. I mean, I used to think, what do you mean? What does darkness have to do with sores? But it's still there all right. the way from the first plague. It hasn't left yet. The healing, there is no healing going on here.
Good point.
Which totally makes sense because God alone is the source of healing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how Jesus demonstrated his kingdom. He went and healed all kinds of diseases.
Right.
Brought healing internally, instantaneously, in many instances, to those who were suffering under the darkness of Satan's rulership and how the world was operating.
Well, this would be the opposite, which is there's no healing even naturally. It just continues and continues and continues, and which would bring hopelessness and despair. Even normally we experience healing. Of course, I still think these are all metaphors, but again, if it's emotional sores, if it's physical sores, any kind of sores, there's no relief that can be gotten anymore. Whereas previously we're used to finding some coping mechanism or some drug or something to numb the pain, and now nothing works.
Well, God is a source of hope, and that's withdrawn.
So are these bowls of wrath this is the part I'm wanting to connect to as well, because Revelation is Babylon language and kingdom language. So in a contrast, are these seven a direct or near direct association, counter allusion to these, you know, Babylonian myth beliefs?
That's a good question, Bill, and I'm not sure I know the answer yet.
Okay.
No, I'm just fine. Starting the study.
Add that to the list of things to think about.
It is, you know, you can go to Egypt with the plagues of Egypt, and you can find the gods of each plague.
Okay.
People have done that. They've mapped it out. It's true, it doesn't say in Revelation that these are judgments on the gods of Babylon.
Okay.
Gotcha. So I'm simply using Egypt, pulling it in and saying, you know, maybe the same is true here. And this is as far as I can go right now.
Sure. Everything we've discussed so far is, for me, satisfactory in terms of understanding the letting go of humanity to reap the natural consequence.
But, you know, from what Floyd said, I'd like to add a Babylonian dimension to that.
Okay.
Imagine a Babylonian suffering from these plagues, and they go to the doctor, the Arnu, and they try to get healing, and the doctor sends him to the exorcist because he can't heal him. And the exorcist demands that he give a lamb, and he tries to exorcise him, and he can't do that. And you can just imagine the panic and the horror of having that kind of situation. And all he goes to the diviners, the Baru priests, divine for him and divine and nothing. It's like the Babylonian poem of the righteous sufferer. All of his ecstasy omens are dark. They're not clear. That's as far as I've gotten. This is going to be a study I never thought I'd be taking, but it's going to be profitable. I'm going to be using it.
I'm asking a question about the question now. Are you asking if the bowls themselves are analogous to something in Babylon, or are you talking about the plagues analogous to something in Babylon?
And Bill, I think that's for you.
Oh, is this for me?
Yeah. Are you?
Sorry,
I was doing
some Google Scholar searching right there, but
when you ask about the bowls, are you thinking that are you asking if the bowls have something analogous to Babylon, or are you asking if the plagues have something analogous to Babylon?
No, I think the former, the bowls
I'd have to study on bowls. I, you know, I don't even know where I'd go to find anything.
Well, because there's how many? Seven. And it would seem like, and again, I'm just hypothesizing because I have no background here other than interest in comparative mythology. So the idea that in our story, it seems like Genesis is a counter to, or at least the beginning of Genesis, is a counter to Babylonian creation myths.
Some one scholar called it a polemic. The first 11 chapters.
Yeah, basically,
Yeah.
yes. I would go with that. So that's just my basic, reading. And I've a couple of books on my shelf for that. But now with Revelation, I'm coming to the end. And so the Bible as a revelation, right? And Revelation gives us the revelation of Jesus Christ. But it seems like the whole narrative is this revelation of this grand conflict as God has worked to reveal truth about himself, truth about not being him and being an adversary to him. So as we come now down to the conclusion of the narrative, it seems like with this, God's done. Like it is finished, not just it is finished in declaration at the cross, but this is, it is finished. Like everyone's made up their mind. With this, there is no further revelation that can be had. I'm, for lack of a better word,
Well,
pontificating.
there is a revelation on the other side of it.
Okay.
This part is finished,
Yeah.
but there is a revelation of the New Jerusalem coming down, God out of heaven. There
That's a
is a
good point.
revelation that God will be wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there is a revelation that they will be with he will be with he will live among his people, and they will be his God.
No, so that I'm looking with the bowls of wrath. This is leading to the end of this.
And see, I don't know if bowls of wrath would have any parallel in Babylonian. It doesn't mean that they wouldn't, because this is not something I can go to the back of a book and look in the index and expect
No,
to
that's fine.
find.
I and it may not need it because of the language all the way through, and we recognize that it is symbolic, and this may go past the symbolism to establish new ground, which is
Now,
also
it
okay.
is possible that, like in, as Floyd has pointed out, the Hebrew censer may have been in a bowl. The Babylonian censers may have been in a bowl. But the Babylonian censers had one aim. Appeasement of the gods. If you ever, I don't know if any of you have ever been in a cloud of incense.
Not to where I
When I
can't
talk,
breathe.
when I, t well, there's that too. But when I taught at Hong Kong Adventist College, we had a new teacher come on campus, and I met with her after church, and we decided to go visit Hong Kong, and I wanted to show her the temples. There was a temple complex in downtown Hong Kong. I can't remember the name of the place either, but Wong Tai Sin, I think it was. Wong Tai Sin temples. And there was this really big temple. There was a cauldron down below in front of it where they did their sacrifices and their offerings. And then you had steps, and you went up to the what would be in the Hebrew way of looking at, because this was very Hebraic, the patterns of the reliefs on the temple pillars were sheep and goats, sacrificial type animals from right out of the Hebrew Bible. But of course, that's also Babylonian. So, and by the way, since we're dealing with basically Asian Orientals, they are related to either one, distantly. They all come from Shem. We went up into the first room. There were two rooms. We went up in the first room. And we were walking along and we noticed people doing things with sticks, and that was divination. And we saw other things going on. And we walked up to the second part. And this cloud of incense enveloped us. And it was burning my eyes. So I had to close my eyes. When I opened them again, my friend was gone. She'd evaporated. She was very tall compared to me. So she probably could be above the cloud of incense, but I couldn't. Anyway, I didn't know where to go to find her, but I followed my kind of my sixth sense and went out past the building and saw her down on the steps. She was walking away from the building, and I quickly got to her because she would have been lost in Hong Kong if I hadn't caught up with her. But what it taught me is when I was in that cloud, it was very soothing. The odor of incense is very soothing. That's why the Babylonians used it to soothe their gods.
A sweet smelling savor is some of our biblical language.
Yes. Sweet smelling savor. That's why, some of my students have pointed out to me in the past that when Noah comes off the ark, you remember he offers these multitudinous sacrifices. And God smelled his sweet smelling savor. It could be translated soothing savor. So Noah built an altar. The Lord smelled the pleasing scent. And the Lord thought to himself, I will not curse the fertile land anymore because of human beings, since the ideas of human mind are evil from their youth. Now, that's not a statement of, oh, I am so soothed. I'm so appeased. Thank you very much. That's a quite opposite statement. You see,
Would Noah
ideas of humankind are evil from their youth.
have been doing the sacrifice for appeasement or simple
It's a
thanksgiving?
good question because, you think of him being on that boat for over a year and feeling like he's never going to get off and having to deal with these animals in very close quarters. I mean, that's a trial. That's very hard to go through that. And it seems to me that he might have acquired some fear of Yahweh.
Personally, I feel like if you put it in a larger context, when Moses went on to that boat, the world was pristine. Like we can't even begin to imagine. And that's all they had ever known. When he comes off that boat, there's almost nothing. It's like walking off on the moon with a few sprigs growing up here and there. I mean, I think the shock to his sensibility is like he landed on a different planet and it was so bleak that I think he was traumatized personally. I think he was in terror that something so horrific had just happened, and he now can see the magnitude of the effects of the flood that he could never see before coming off that boat. That he's doing something almost irrational, and he's like going into panic mode and says, okay, we got to appease this God. I don't want, I'm terrified this over. I mean, the Tower of Babel, same thing. They're still traumatized thinking this God is going to do it again. We can't even trust him. He said he's not going to do it, but I don't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it go either way, and I can also see him coming off after his time and seeing all the changes and thankful that Yahweh has been with him, whatever they were calling him at the time.
Well, he might have a combination of those emotions. Yeah,
right.
The thing is that he offers an awful lot of animals.
Yes.
Way more than he needed to.
Right.
And I think that's why God makes the statement he has. Nothing has changed. They're still slaughtering everything.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think the universe got a very clear picture of what violence does. Even though I don't believe God caused the flood, they still got a picture of what violence can do to the human psyche.
I go walking around during barbecue season, and it's like,
there you go.
It's like, sweet, that smells so good, and it's charred flesh, you know.
I think it's the additives they put in there to make it smell sweet, though.
I don't know. I have some Argentine friends who really do barbecue well.
But they always
and it doesn't
put,
need.
They don't put anything on it.
Not unless you want to afterwards, but it's really about the smoke and the wood that they choose.
But that's still adding a specific flavoring, even if it's the smoke of the wood. It still has a specific personality to it.
Correct. I would agree to that.
So
yeah, it's not just charcoal.
This has the God smelled the pleasing scent. Most translators will not do the sweet smelling savor.
Somewhere we've just picked that up.
I find myself thinking of we got to go to the Ark Encounter in Kentucky. Don't know if anybody's been there. Quite an impressive boat built to the specifications of the Ark, and incredibly well thought out, you know, where they would have water, a water system and waste removal. And, you know, you just think about Noah and his family, you know, during that time. And if you're in charge of taking care of animals, there's some kind of connection that occurs. And I just find myself wondering if Noah, you know, recognized the pain that God had to go through by in order to preserve the line for Messiah to come to save everyone, that the flood allowed that to happen. Because when I taught the flood to kids, which is a hard teach, you know, in the verse we went over and over, every thought was only evil all the time. So, and you get down to one family. And I just can't help myself but think that Noah in those close quarters and that interconnection, feeding and taking care of these animals for, you know, over a year, that was a connection. And I think he must have got the pain and utter sadness that God went through seeing the destruction of life. You know, I'd have to read Ellen again to review what was that sacrifice about. But I think that would have to bring home to Noah, you know, a little tiny experience of what God experienced, loving all of these life forms that he has created and seeing them die in the flood. Anyway, I just think often the stories are for us to try to start to understand what God feels, which is incredible pain and sadness and loss.
There's another aspect to this, what God says to Noah after he offered those animals. God blessed Noah and his sons and said, be fertile and multiply and fill the earth. All of the animals on the earth will fear you and dread you. Where did that fear begin? It began with him offering all of those sacrifices. But then he says, I will surely demand your blood for a human life. From every living thing, I will demand it. From humans, from a man, for his brother, I will demand something for a human life. Whoever shares human blood, by human blood, his blood will be shed. For a divine image, God made human beings. It's a sad time. And there are no easy answers. But one of my former colleagues, Donald John, used to say that God sped up the process that was already going on. And I honestly believe that, and I don't say this is a is, but it could be that the violence created the flood. Because if Cain could no longer grow anything on the land that had to swallow Abel's blood would not produce anything for him. What would wholesale blood everywhere, all the time, do to the planet? We have the butterfly effect. It seems to be a real thing. And all we would need is for the earth to violently erupt in an earthquake. If it did it in the right location, we would have a flood.
We have plenty of evidence in terms of meteor strike possibilities, that they could have done something themselves to the whole ecosystem. Listening to the record, it would be sharp, razor sharp minds and intellects thinking up ways to harm, not just stab your brother, but inventing ways to harm each other.
Yeah, it says that the imagination of your thoughts are only evil continually. It means they couldn't think a good thing.
Well, we came up with atomic bombs.
Yeah.
And our intellect was much inferior to theirs. And I see God intervening to save the planet, even though that upended the planet. And, you know, there's a whole world of people that have repopulated. And I'm glad God put some fear of the animals, because lions and tigers and bears, and you got one family. So I'm glad that there was that fear factor that helped the human race survive in hostile conditions with more animals than people, for sure. So we'll get to learn a lot once we're in heaven. But, you know, I know God intervenes at times, but his goal is always to try to save people as he possibly can, even in these sometimes difficult stories like the flood and Gomorrah. And we're reading through the Old Testament and plagues and stuff happening. I go, okay, God is still trying to preserve. And what he does is always to ultimately bring life, especially life number two. Life number one is asleep. We don't have to be afraid of God wants to bring us into eternity to connect with him forever and ever.
Right.
So that's the good news, I think.
So did we do one bowl?
One bowl. That's all we did.
And what would be the significance that the bowl was targeting the earth versus all the rest of the targets? And does the earth, the symbol of the earth, is that more relevant to sores or wounds than water or sun or air?
Well, keep in mind the Babylonians, like all the other people in the ancient Near East, worshipped the forces of the earth. They were gods. I believe, and I'm going to have to check this out, I believe that Enlil was the lord of the, either lord of the air or, oh, I'm sorry. Ea is Lord of the Earth in his name, Enki. Enki is his Sumerian name. Ea is his Babylonian name. Ea is house of water, I think. Ea was the god of fresh water. Tiamat was the god of salt water. Goddess of salt water.
So who's the god of the earth or ground?
Well, see, it's confusing, and everything in Babylonian is confusing because you have Enki, En is Lord, Ki is Earth, Lord of the Earth. But Enlil, who is En, Lord of the Air, Lil, has also been thought to be Lord of the Earth. So I have a handbook of gods and goddesses, and I have several dictionaries of gods and goddesses. So I'm going to have to be looking through that to find out.
Yeah, it just seems like there would probably be some sort of logical connection between a deity that claims the earth, literally ground, as their domain, and some kind of relation to wounds and sores. I would just assume there must be some connection.
I'll see if I can find it.
I mean, you also have stoning and rocks, which is clearly using earth to inflict deadly wounds.
Right. But
That's
the Babylonians didn't know stoning because they didn't have any rocks. They had alluvial soil. Now, stoning is Israelite because Palestine is full of rocks.
Yeah.
I'm going to ProQuest because I'm looking for your dissertation, Jean. So I got distracted there.
ProQuest, you'll need to look under Linda Jean Sheldon.
Oh, that's okay.
You won't find it under Jean Sheldon at all.
It was not coming out.
It was the University of California that cursed me and having to use something other than L. Jean Sheldon.
I put the title in there. It's the Book of Job as Hebrew Theodicy. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Anyway, I'll do this later. I'm addicted to data and research, and I've got Graham's dissertation on, you know, so.
Well, good luck.
I got it on preview, but I wanted to get it downloaded, and I have to log in. So,
to my amazement, my mother read my dissertation all the way through. You know how mothers are. My father wouldn't touch it. I think he maybe started, but he didn't last very long.
I'm an academic, so I've read several, and each one just brings richness. Now, I have a book that reads like a dense dissertation, so I can't say because I haven't read yours, but most dissertations I've read are readable.
Well, mine is a gulp, 417 pages.
Oh, yeah, it's a long one. Okay. I'll take some time.
One of my colleagues complained that he'd never known anyone who had ever done a dissertation on the whole book of Job. And when he said that several times, I finally said, well, I'm a holistic thinker. I have to do the whole book.
That was, yeah, I understand. If it's going to make sense, then, you know, at least you were able to narrow
stop.
It to one
I,
of 66.
You know, I was going to do Leviathan in Job.
Okay.
That was what I was originally planning to do. And I couldn't stop once I got started. Everything connected to everything else, to everything else. And finally, I just ended up doing the book.
Are you happy you did?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, see, that's the...
I've been this curious person ever since I was two. My mother tells the story of how I was sitting on the edge of the bathtub. She was drying me off. I was 2 years old, and she said, I started to slip. And she said, careful, Jeannie, don't lose your balance. And I looked at her and I said, Mommy, what's my balance and how can I lose it?
Nice. Did you figure that out and give yourself an answer, or did she give you one?
I don't know, because she's the
Okay.
one that told me the story. I don't
Oh,
remember.
okay. Yeah.
The one I do remember it to was not savory at all. I
Soap? No.
I was being potty trained. It had to do with that. And I made a discovery of what came out of my body. And I went, picked it up and went to my mother, who was getting some dinner. And I said, Mommy, what's this?
Oh, that's classic. That's great.
And my poor mother, she quickly ushered me back to the bathroom saying, this is dirty, dirty, dirty. She had me put it in the right spot.
Yeah.
And so I began to think, you know, maybe there are some questions I shouldn't raise. So I stopped asking too many questions of my parents, and I just thought of them in my head and wondered what the answers were. Because I am a questioner.
It is curiosity in action.
Well, I take comfort in the statement by Ellen White, let the ingenious inquirer, one who seeks to know what is truth. And it goes on from there and is a very positive statement. I appreciate that. Because some people would ban questions if they could.
It's threatening.
Well, I used to be terrible at teaching Sabbath school class. And I say that honestly, I don't think I should have ever done this. I didn't do it to my students, but I did it to the adults who were in my class. I would ask a question, and if they didn't have the answer I was looking for, I would ask another question, and then another question, and another question, and the whole Sabbath school might be questions, and then them giving me answers. And at the end of it, I would give myself about 15 minutes where I give my answer. It's very succinct and to the point. After I had a breakdown, I decided that I had a tendency to sound arrogant giving those questions out. And so I quit. I completely abandoned that. Well, one day I happened to mention this to my Sabbath school class when we used to meet in the religion department. And they said, why don't you do that now? We'd like you to do that now. So the next time I came to teach, I did it. And the first question, I could just see them kind of like fly back like they were threatened somehow. And so I kind of slowed it down and I stopped. And they didn't ask me to do it again. So I don't.
Well,
That's
I
why
remember
I'm here.
It in Bering Springs. Everybody liked to go to Dr. Keish's class. And most of the time, didn't matter what the topic was, although it might have been, it probably was relevant to the topic, but he would present actually a real life moral dilemma question. because, you know, he was a professor of ethics, and they sent him all over the world to deal with moral dilemmas that nobody else could figure out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would tell a story from South Africa or someplace,
mm-hmm.
and say, so what would you do? And we're sitting here going, no clue. You know, it's like, then he would teach his Sabbath school class, you know, and talk about whatever the topic was, which was usually something related to it. And then he'd get to the end of the class, and then he would share what he did. And it was always mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I would have never thought of that. But it was brilliant, you know. And, one of the things that, of course, it was took up about a quarter of the sanctuary, you know, his class, because it was very popular. And he co-taught with Gerhard Hassel,
mm-hmm.
which was a good teacher, but definitely very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, my questions were very simple, and not simple in the sense of being easy, but they were short and tended to the point. And nobody could think of an answer. And I think doing that over and over again just made it hard.
Mm-hmm.
But my original class that I taught didn't seem to be offended by it.
Sometimes I get frustrated with teachers, and even frustrated with myself when I catch myself doing it, of asking questions but expecting only one right answer.
Yeah.
And that gets discouraging, because if you know the teacher is only going to accept one answer and it's the one they already have in their head, now it's just a guessing game, and that's not really study.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, what I did, I accepted any answer that I felt was plausible and would fill the boat. When I kept asking questions, it was when I wanted them to think a little deeper around those answers.
Yeah.
Anyway, I find that the generation I'm teaching now, the Gen Z generation, does not do well. They don't even want to answer any questions. And I found out from my niece, who did research on how this generation was educated in the lower grades. They were educated to be told, spoon-fed every fact, spoon-fed every thought, spoon-fed everything. They were not taught to think, especially for themselves. And they're just like, they're not wired to.
Mm.
They've been deprived of something they should have. But the thing that I appreciate about this generation is they are very interested in the character of God.
Mm.
So that's what keeps me going.
Well, thank you guys. We need to
Well, let's have a word of prayer.
Okay.
Here we go. Father, we thank you that you have given us a book that not only gives us an understanding of you, but an understanding of where we could have gone had you not intervened and come to this earth.
Mm-hmm.
We ask that we may appreciate all the more the message of your goodness and mercy and undying love. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.